Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. Sorry about that. I got a little frog in my throat today. So we've got Paul Venable, and as a matter of fact, I don't want to say there was fur flying or anything else, but it seemed like we were kind of going through some clarity regarding treaties and the procurement of land. And so is that not correct, Paul?
Well, that's correct, because the question I had asked you, I'd heard before, and I'd never really researched it.
Yeah.
I had always believed that the acquisition of the the Louisiana Purchase was constitutional, but I was kind of taken aback by the question. Then you asked, well, how do we acquire Alaska? Okay, so
right.
So what we did is we purchased the land from France, and Jefferson submitted it, the agreement, to the Senate, which.
Yeah, so I forget how it came down.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if Jefferson actually authorized it or if it was basically a procurement that was kind of thrown out that says, we're going to go ahead and buy this land if Jefferson buys off on this, a deal like that. And instead, the emissary probably made a mistake and made Napoleon believe that this was in the power of Jefferson. Because I just don't think that the emissary, because, these guys were cutting their teeth. This was like the first time we ever made a treaty like this. So,
right?
Okay, I'm going through this path in the snow for the first time. It's going to be cumbersome. And clearly, they do have the responsibility over territories or even acquiring for admitting states into the Union. The design was that they would expand westward. Is it in our benefit to actually create a condition where we can expand even further? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And do they have the authority to manage that land or to permanently possess it? Yes, they have the authority to manage that land into becoming states. They do not have the authority to permanently possess land. The states absolutely need to stand up with all of these lands that are called,
territories,
and say, piss or get off the pot, federal government, because you're using that as a mechanism to drain our resources, because we've pumped nothing but money and money and money into Puerto Rico.
Right.
And they're going to continually spend like drunken sailors.
And remember, the incentive for states is that the money doesn't flow into a territory. It flows from the state to support the federal government.
That is right. And so that's why there's an incentive for the federal government to obtain territories and to grow, so that these states actually provide revenue. So a territory does not have the ability to pay revenue. It becomes a sucking chest wound if you're not tending to it right. And that's exactly what Puerto Rico has done.
Right.
We either set them free or they actually become a state.
Right.
Period.
Right. And there are a lot of people who have objected to Puerto Rico becoming a state over the years. If they're a territory, like you said, then let them be a state, or let them go. But you're correct. I want to make sure I get this, so that let's just lay it out for a second. The history, I looked it up, and we probably don't have time to read this right now, but I'm gonna go over it after we're done and make sure that I understand this. This says the United States purchased from France in 1803. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And then, Okay, and I need to research it. I don't want to use up our airtime to.
So when we look at and what you can do is you can just look up all of the procurements of land by the United States government. So we ended up, you know, buying Florida.
Right.
It's not like we went out and conquered. Now,
right.
I'm going to actually, because you've asked this question, and there's a lot of misnomers and bad information out there. Mm-hmm. Most people think that, you know, we were colonists in creating these colonies. What we did is we exerted our international rights within the international community of staking claim to available land. Now, there may have been people on that land. There may have been, you know, gold resources, what have you. But the real reason why we procured the land wasn't to oppress people, wasn't to steal their wealth, wasn't to, you know, do bad things. It was to secure our nation and actually protect ourselves, because it was in our interest to basically have, from sea to shining sea, a nation where we could defend it from the water.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you got your enemy coming from the water, and what it did was it actually gave us a border of a friendly nation to the north and what we thought was a friendly nation to the south.
Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind, what would have happened had Mexico, so let me ask you this, and look at Canada and Mexico,
right,
and look at how the indigenous people and their rights have been recognized.
Not very well.
Not very well at all. As a matter of fact, you don't hear much in Canada, right? But we know what happened in Mexico. You know, they were all basically, what do you want to call them, raped or what have you, to create an intermingling race, which actually created the Mexicans, right?
Okay, yeah. Spain came down and intermingled with the people in the area. Right?
Absolutely. That's how they basically made it so it would be impossible for them to rise up against themselves.
But you know, here's another element that gets missed in history, and I've only heard it from you, okay? And that is that at one time Mexico considered being a state,
yeah.
And the Missouri Compromise is what blew them off.
Yeah, and actually there was an appeal prior to the Constitution for Canada to become a state in the Union, and so that too was, you know, blown off as well. I think that appeal to Mexico was in the mid-1820s, 1830s, something like that. But
okay,
the appeal to Mexico was, you know, while they were struggling to, you know, for their independence, and they had problems. As a matter of fact, the reality is if you actually go read and you check, you'll find that we paid Mexico twice for the same land.
What?
We paid Mexico twice. Santa Ana, you know, we bought land from Santa Ana. And then Santa Ana came back and said, you know what, that land was worth more, and, you know, we need you to give us more money. And then basically he just said, you know, we need you to fund us, and, you know, we're either going to fight you over this land or you're going to have to pay us. Because he was desperate for money. And I guess we were so well off, we went ahead and paid him twice.
I did not know.
Most
that.
People don't. But yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of embarrassing that, you know, we got shook down by Santa Ana, you know, because mm-hmm. we made these alliances with him and we kind of really supported him. So anyway, are we good on this though?
Because let's be good on this right now.
Okay.
You know, otherwise it'll be a while before we get back to the document.
All right.
Okay.
All right. So let's go ahead and pick up where we left off, because where we left off was it was still May, and there was still, and we heard the first contention that, you know, this wasn't in the commission, right? And right. So at this point, we hear, you know, Sherman speaks out against democracy. That was what we just covered. And then we get down to, you know, Madison and how they're kind of figuring out the direction to go. And go ahead.
So this is May 31st, 1787.
Yep.
And we're hearing from Mr. Madison considered the popular election of one branch, the national legislature, as essential to every plan of free government. He observed that in some of the states, one branch of the legislature was composed of men already removed from the people by an intervening body of electors. That if the first branch of the general legislature should be elected by the state legislatures, the second branch elected by the first, the executive by the second together with the first, and other appointments again made after subordinate purposes by the executive, the people would be lost sight of altogether, and the necessary sympathy between them and their rulers and officers too little felt. He was an advocate for the policy of refining the popular appointments by successive filtrations, but though it might be pushed too far, he wished the expedient to be resorted to only in the appointment of the second branch of the legislature and in the executive and judiciary branches of government. He thought, too, that the great fabric to be raised would be more stable and durable if it should rest on the solid foundation of the people themselves than if it should stand merely on the pillars of the legislatures.
Right. So Madison's writing in the third person.
Right. He's writing his own thoughts in the third person, right? And so, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting how he's conveying his thoughts here. But he's really pointing out that the direction that they were going was still going to lose sight of the people.
Right.
Currently, Continental Congress, how was Continental Congress basically established? So the delegates that were acting in Continental Congress was appointed by the state legislature. In other words, there was no... there was no vesting in the people at all in this national government.
Okay.
And Madison felt that it was important that the people had representation in this government.
Mm-hmm.
And that the government, so, you know, we're kind of glossing over something that is really, this goes to why counties matter most. What Madison is clearly delineating is ensuring and embedding in at every level of government the people's involvement, that the predilection at their point in time and the trend that everybody was going to continue going down was that government begot government once the people created their government. So here's why this was so important, and here's this divine nature of our Republican form of government. Okay. When we created the counties, then that what ended up happening in these new territories, we were just talking about territories being basically transitioned into states. So what ended up happening was that the territory transitioned and was established by counties. And once the counties grew to a point, the counties formed the states. And in line with what Madison is talking about, there was to be representation of the people. You know, obviously they had their government, which is the county. And they, the counties, created the state, which gave the people representation as well. But the counties also had their own representation. That model was maintained. That mm-hmm. What Madison is talking about here was a fundamental shift that I think Roger Sherman then quickly integrated. And that's one of the reasons why we find, you know, the Sherman plan kind of was introduced well before some of these other plans that were absolutely rejected when people tried to go back to a doctrine of magistrate.
So the Sherman plan initially involved representation by the people. Is that correct?
So the Virginia plan did that, right. And okay. then the Sherman plan, when it was introduced, I think it was introduced, I'm going to go down here. I'm pretty sure it was introduced on the 11th. Hamilton's okay. plan was June 18th, and I believe it was somewhere on the 11th when Sherman's plan was introduced. Mm-hmm. I can't find it, but I believe I made a note for it. And so when we get to it, we'll find it. I apologize. But at this point, Madison has just made these notes of how important it is to have this integrated, tiered government, that the people had representation at every level of our government. And that the, you know, at the next level up, that government would have representation in that government. So that's how we formed bicameral legislative bodies. So here's the question. When counties grow to a certain point, to where when we look at Orange County has county legislators. They actually have a legislature in Orange County and throughout New York. The counties have legislatures. I guess if they're so big, they obtain this legislature. Well, so if they've obtained this legislature to where there's these districts, there's that many districts, then why is it that the county, Orange County and these other counties in New York, these districts didn't actually create, you know, their own little layer of governance, creating their own little constitution, and then dictating a Senate within that legislative body? Why did they maintain a unicameral legislation in a heavily populated county?
I think as time went on, there was a shift in understanding or lack of understanding the Constitution that counties are subject to the states. I think this was a transition, because today the mindset is that counties are administrative sub-elements of the states. I believe most county commissioners believe this. I believe most people believe this. I can't identify where the transition in thinking took place, but uh-huh. I believe it's been lost over time. Okay? That's why your document, Why Counties Matter Most, just reignites this understanding.
Okay. Well, clearly Madison is understanding the importance, because government should never lose sight of the people. But it should never lose sight of that sub-government either. See, he was making the point that the people need to have representation all the way up. That didn't happen in Rome. That didn't happen in the Roman Empire. So they wanted to make sure that the people were represented. But we lost complete sight of having suffrage or representation for that sub-element of government underneath us.
Correct.
Okay. So, Mr. Gary.
Okay. Mr. Gary.
Uh-huh.
Jerry, can you hear me?
Yeah, so I think you got a sound problem. And so if that's...
Okay, here we go.
There you go. That's much better.
Yeah,
there
we go.
That's better.
Something came loose. Mr. Gary did not like the election by the people. The maxims taken from the British Constitution were often fallacious when applied to our situation, which was extremely different. Experience, he said, had shown that the state legislatures drawn immediately from the people did not always possess their confidence. He had no objection, however, to an election by the people if it were so qualified that men of honor and character might not be unwilling to be joined in the appointments. He seemed to think the people might nominate a certain number out of which the state legislatures should be bound to choose. You know, remember,
yeah. uh-huh.
Madison is writing these notes.
Yep.
And so he is coloring what people are saying with his own view.
Yeah.
And I can tell, you know, what he's...
Oh,
I can see
yes.
that here.
Okay, yes.
go ahead. So you want me to go on?
Yeah, go on. It's now. So now you're going to go through, you know, some functions. But go ahead, Mr. Butler.
Okay. So Mr. Butler thought an election by the people an impracticable mode. On the question for an election of the first branch of the national legislature by the people, Massachusetts.
Okay, so they actually took it to a vote of the delegates, right? So now they're going to basically tell you how it went, because here's this, you know, I believe we need to maintain, you know, the people's voice, and we don't need to maintain it. So go ahead.
So that must have been the vote. So here we go. Massachusetts, aye. Connecticut, divided. New York, aye. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, aye. Delaware, divided. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, aye. South Carolina, no. Georgia, aye. That sounds like the idea. One, the remaining clauses of – did you want to say something?
No, go ahead. Keep going.
The remaining clauses of Resolution 4th relating to the qualifications of members of the national legislature being proposed, NEMCON – I don't know what that is – being I don't know what the – postponed NEMCON as entering too much into detail for general propositions.
Right.
Okay, there's too many abbreviations there, and so I don't know what they meant.
Okay.
The committee proceeded to Resolution 5, quote, that the second or senatorial branch of the national legislature ought to be chosen by the first branch out of the persons nominated by state legislators.
Okay.
Okay.
There you go. Okay, so what they're doing here, remember, there was a resolution that I believe was presented by Randolph, basically saying that this is what we need to do, and these are some resolutions we submit. So they're going through the Virginia plan, and they're arguing and discussing, you know, each of the resolutions. So now they've done dealt with the fourth, and now they're going through the fifth. And so Mr. Spate of North Carolina then basically contends what?
Contended that the second branch ought to be chosen by the state legislatures and moved an amendment to that effect. Mr. Butler apprehended that the taking so many powers out of the hands of the states as was proposed tended to destroy all that balance and security of interests among the states, which it was necessary to preserve, and called on Mr. Randolph, the mover of the propositions, to explain the extent of his ideas, and particularly the number of members he meant to assign to the second branch. So Mr. Randolph observed that he had at the time of offering his proposition stated his idea as far as the nature of general propositions required, that details made no part of the plan and could not perhaps with propriety have been introduced. If he was to give an opinion as to the number of the second branch, he should say that it ought to be much smaller than that of the first, so small as to be exempt from the passionate proceedings to which numerous assemblies are liable. He observed that the general object was to provide a cure for the evils under which the U.S. labored, that in tracing these evils to their origin, every man had found it in the turbulence and follies of democracy, that some check, therefore, was to be sought for against this tendency of our governments, and that a good Senate seemed most likely to answer the purpose.
Yeah, and so one of the things that they were basically, we only got a couple seconds here, but it was bringing them to the importance of unity or uniformity, where each state had equal representation in this second branch, the second branch being the Senate, because obviously this is already kind of taking form. But there was still they were buying into this idea, and this idea obviously came from the Madison Plan. But the important part was that there was this compromise, because they still, not everybody bought into this. And it was, I think, Sherman that kind of brought the two sides together, which is why they moved forward on that compromise. And so obviously, we're going into break, so hold on, folks. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so Mr. Randolph kind of basically responded to Mr. Spate, and who didn't like the idea of, you know, this, I'll just say the first branch. He wanted to maintain the state legislature, and anyway, so now Mr. King is going to respond and throw in his number, and so okay. There you go. Go ahead.
Mr. King reminded the committee that the choice of the second branch, as proposed by Mr. Spate, viz. By the state legislatures, would be impracticable unless it was to be very numerous or the idea of proportion among the states was to be disregarded. According to this idea, there must be 80 or 100 members to entitle Delaware to a choice of one of them.
Okay.
Mr. Spate withdrew his motion. Now I'm trying to understand where this has wound up. Mr. King believes that
he believes that
it has to be numerous?
Yeah. So when we started off, there was this idea that there was going to be the second branch, right? So
right.
Mr. Spate basically contended, this is the importance of the Senate, that the second branch ought to be chosen by the state legislatures, and moved an amendment to that effect, that instead of having the first branch select the Senate,
right,
the second branch. But Mr. Butler apprehended, now Mr. Butler, different person, apprehended that taking so many powers out of the hands of the states, as was proposed, tended to destroy all that balance and security of the interest among the states in which was necessary to preserve, and called on Mr. Randolph, the mover, it was his proposition, his plan, to explain the extent of his ideas and particularly the number of member he meant to assign to the second branch. And then Mr. Randolph, Governor Randolph, and it's interesting that Madison is calling Randolph Mr. instead of Governor.
Okay.
He was a governor. But he does point out Governor Morris, you'll notice, throughout this, as a governor.
Well, so, wait, wasn't this guy's name Governor?
No, Governor Morris was a governor at the time. There were a couple of governors that actually attended the debates. Governor Randolph was a governor of Virginia.
Why did they spell his name Governor?
I think it's just there's lots of misspellings. Like if you notice throughout here, Madison, whoever is adopting his pen, because he's writing this with a pen, they're basically just translating it by, you know, either misspells or what have you. Because Sherman is mentioned as Charman, Sharman.
Right.
And so why is that happening? Because the translation wasn't that, you know, perfect. It wasn't. And Madison's handwriting and misspellings contributed to that.
I just looked up Governor Morris, and that was his name. He had a child, Governor Morris II, G-O-U-V-E-R-N-E-U-R.
Okay. Was he not the governor then?
It doesn't. I'm looking. He was a United States senator, United States minister to France. It doesn't say he was a governor.
Okay.
But it's spelled Governor.
Okay.
And so I just I have heard that, and I thought that spelling was right.
Well, okay, so if that was his first name, then why include the first name? Because you don't include the first name for everybody else. It's a title. It's just like George Mason's first name wasn't Colonel, and we're going to find that he actually calls him Colonel Mason.
Weird. It's okay. I don't know.
All right.
Okay. Weird. So we did Mr. King, and then.
Okay. Right? So Mr. Speight withdrew his motion. So now,
right.
Mr. Wilson. Right.
Mr. Wilson opposed both a nomination by the state legislatures and an election by the first branch of the national legislature, because the second branch of the latter ought to be independent of both. He thought both branches of the national legislature ought to be chosen by the people, but was not prepared with a specific proposition. He suggested the mode of choosing the Senate of New York, to wit, of uniting several election districts for one branch by choosing members for the other branch as a good model.
Anyway, so he didn't have a good plan. He just felt that both branches should be elected by the people.
Okay. Mr. Madison observed that such a mode would destroy the influence of the smaller states associated with larger ones in the same district, as the latter would choose from within themselves, although better men might be found in the former. The election of senators in Virginia, where large and small counties were often formed into one district for the purpose, had illustrated this consequence. Local partiality would often prefer a resident within a county or state to a candidate of superior merit residing out of it. Less merit also in a resident would be more known throughout his own state. GR, I want to pay a little attention to this.
Okay,
because it sounds confusing, and it sounds like he's describing the legislature of Virginia.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And he says, where large and small counties were often formed into one district for the purpose.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So does that mean that in their, let's say, did Virginia, the state of Virginia, have a bicameral legislature that was modeled the way they wanted the Constitution to work?
I'd have to look at it. They may have actually had, there were a couple of states that actually had bicameral legislation.
Okay.
Most of them were unicameral.
Okay.
And I believe, was it Virginia? Was the House of Burgess?
Yes, Virginia was the House of Burgesses.
Okay. So
correct.
That, I believe that was bicameral.
Okay. And so, it's interesting that they bring here large and small counties are formed into a district because, and I'll tell you, before Baker v. Carr or Reynolds v. Sims, in Idaho, counties were represented by had representatives, but senators were in districts. And I, as reading this, I remember, so it looks like they put, and that's from the beginning. Okay, mm-hmm. So in other words, each county didn't have a senator, but they looked like they put counties together to make a Senate district. And so I thought that was interesting. I just want to bring that up because we may come back to it later.
Yeah, so they had to create some form of – so here's the question. How were those senators appointed? Were they appointed by the people? Or were they appointed by the county legislators? That's the question. And so the whole point of what we're going through, and I know that everybody's going, you know, this is all over the place. You know, why are we even listening to this? Because this was how they were struggling with all of these ideas. It boiled down to this, that, and this is what I repeat throughout, why counties matter most. If the principle, if this is the true resounding principle of our form of government, that mm-hmm. we the people institute our government, then our government is a sovereign for us. And in the next level of government up it should have a level of suffrage in a body known as a Senate, where it is maintaining and protecting those things that our counties, which we create, the real government that we, the people, create is our counties. And so our counties must be able to protect the matters of commerce and the matters of industry and those things that we, the people, won't care about. Right. Because we could actually become, you know, the makers of our own doom if we continually ask for government to tend to us. And so the Senate should actually keep everything in check to say, hey, you know, you can't do all of that, because what you're going to end up doing is you're going to be basically destroying corporations. Bottom line, the desires of the people keep in check the desires of industry, and the desires of industry keep in check, or I should say, vice versa. And the desires of industry are kept in check by the people, so that the corporations don't get out of hand. That, you know, there's this balance in our county and government, just like there's a balance at the state level to ensure that it maintains this balance. And that's why this is the model that they created. The one thing that they didn't do in the Constitution is they didn't put in the Article 4 or Article 6 that all states need to reform or be formed based on this model. What they did was they left it to the states to try to figure out how to implement some legislative body that's Republican in form.
Right.
And everybody tried to copy, and everybody did actually copy bicameral legislation.
Sure.
How they interpreted it, and it became a petri dish. There was no enforcement of you had to follow this. But I am telling you that as I see the divinity in this system, that the states that actually implement literally this system, they are going to be better served, that their government and their constitutions will serve their liberties better.
Right.
If you start empowering government at a central level, then they're going to continue to centralize more and more power. But when you limit it and define it, and then you actually distribute the powers to the different levels, this is why is it that there's not one state constitution that has anything like the 10th Amendment? That powers not delegated to the state are reserved to the counties and the people respectively. Why did they never include that?
I think they considered the states as the basic element.
I think that it didn't take long to where I believe that that was the prevailing push that the federal government wanted, because they started centralizing powers in the mid-18-teens. In other words, they started actually trying to get out of the box and centralizing powers in 1816 with Indiana. And as they started bringing more and more states into the union, they literally, and because I go through this in these enabling acts, how is it that the federal government started asserting this stuff when they didn't have the authority? They were trying to make sure, and they were trying to create this path forward by bringing more and more states into the union that they had full control over. Yeah. And then that would have forced every other state. And what they ended up doing as they started acquiring more and more money coming in, they were successful in buying these other states. Buying them by saying, we want you to invoke these regulations and here's the money to do it.
Right.
It's almost like the mob boss coming and saying, we want you to do this for us and here's the money to go do it. Just go do it. Well, it's wrong. Well, here's the money. Go do it. And nine times out of ten, when you put money in somebody's hands, say, oh, you've given me money and you want me to go do this? Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, sure, be happy to.
Yeah.
Okay, so hopefully that helps.
Yeah.
And so, Mr. Sherman, let's just keep going through this, right?
Favorite an election of one member by each of the state legislatures. Mr. Pinckney moved to strike out the quote, nomination by the state legislatures, unquote, on this question. So now there's a vote.
Yes.
Okay. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, no. New York, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware divided. Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, no. Georgia, apparently that was a no.
Yep.
On the whole question for electing by the first branch out of nominations by the state legislatures.
Uh-huh.
Massachusetts, aye. Connecticut, no. New York, no. New Jersey, no. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, aye. Georgia, no. Now, this is interesting. Now, isn't this where we are now? Electing by the first branch.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. They chose to do that.
So the first was the nomination by the state legislatures, and on this question, they voted no. On the whole question for electing by the first branch out of nominations by the state legislatures, no.
Right.
Okay, so the clause was disagreed to and a chasm left in this part of the plan. In other words, they couldn't move forward. Right. Neither way, either by electing by the state nominations by the state legislatures and or electing by nominations of the, because I think that was the second one,
right.
Question, by electing for the first branch out of the nominations. So in other words, they didn't have a way forward because the plan submitted exactly that the second branch would actually be elected by the first from nominations of the second.
Right.
And so both plans kind of adapted to that same thesis, and it failed. So the sixth resolution stayed, and so they moved on.
Okay. So this clause is disagreed to, and the chasm left in this part of the plan. The sixth resolution stating the cases in which the national legislature ought to legislate was next taken into discussion. On the question whether each branch should originate laws, there was an unanimous affirmative without debate. On the question for transferring all the legislative powers of the existing Congress to this assembly, there was also a silent affirmative NEMCON, whatever that is. On the proposition for giving, quote, legislative power in all cases to which the state legislatures were individually competent, Mr. Pinckney and Mr. Rutledge objected to the vagueness of the term, individually incompetent.
Uh-huh.
Legislative power in all cases to which the state legislatures were individually incompetent.
Right. Okay. Keep going.
Okay. Mr. Pinckney and Mr. Rutledge objected to the vagueness of the term incompetent and said they could not well decide how to vote until they should see an exact enumeration of the powers comprehended by this definition. Mr. Butler repeated his fears that we were running into an extreme in taking away the powers of the states and called on Mr. Randolph for the extent of his meaning. Mr. Randolph disclaimed any intention to give indefinite powers to the national legislature, declaring that he was entirely opposed to such an inroad on the state jurisdictions, and that he did not think any considerations whatever could ever change his determination. His opinion was fixed on this point.
Okay.
Mr. Madison said that he had brought with him into the convention a strong bias in favor of an enumeration and definition of the powers necessary to be exercised by the national legislature, but had also brought doubts concerning its practicability. His wishes remained unaltered, but his doubts had become stronger. What his opinion might ultimately be, he could not yet tell, but he should shrink from nothing which should be found essential to such a form of government as would provide for the safety, liberty, and happiness of the community. This being the end of all our deliberations, all the necessary means for attaining it must, however reluctantly, be submitted to. On the question for giving powers in cases to which the states are not competent, Massachusetts, aye. Connecticut, divided. New York, aye. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, aye. Delaware, aye. Virginia, aye. North Carolina, aye. South Carolina, aye. Georgia, aye. This sounds like they were with the exception of Connecticut, were all agreed on what?
Uh-huh.
Giving powers in cases to which the states are not competent. I'm still not sure I understand what this means.
Giving powers to the central government. So go back up here, and he kind of talks about, said that he had brought with him into the convention a strong bias in favor of an enumeration and definition of the powers necessary to be exercised by the national legislature. So it's talk about giving them the power over things that the states weren't competent.
Okay.
But he brought doubts concerning its practicability. His wishes remained unaltered, but his doubts had become stronger. What his opinion might ultimately be, he could not tell. This is Madison talking about himself.
Yeah, right.
But he should shrink from nothing which should be found essential to such a form of government as would provide for the safety, liberty, and happiness of the community. When he says community, he's talking about the union, the nation. This being the end of all deliberations, all the necessary means for attaining it must, however, reluctantly be submitted to. So in other words, he's still advocating more central powers. And so he said, hey, if the states aren't competent in doing this, this has to be given to the federal government.
And apparently most of the states agreed with him.
There you go. Even Delaware said yes, okay.
Right, okay.
Now, the other clause, go ahead.
The other clause is giving powers necessary to preserve harmony among the states to negative all state laws contravening in the opinion of the national legislature, the Articles of Union, down to the last clause, the words, quote, or any treaties subsisting under the authority of the Union, end quote, being added after the words, quote, contravening, etc., the Articles of the Union, end quote.
Uh-huh.
In motion of Dr. Franklin, were agreed to with debate
without
debate or dissent.
Without debate.
Right. I caught that.
Okay.
Without debate or dissent. The last clause of Resolution 6 authorizing the exertion of force of the whole against a delinquent state came next into consideration.
Okay.
Because I'm reading this,
uh-huh.
I see the words. If I'm challenged in following this, I'm sure our listeners are a little bit challenged as well. Okay.
Right.
But I'll go on because I'm guessing that we're going to get clarity.
They're also saying is that they wanted to preserve harmony among the states to negative all state laws contravening in the opinion of the national legislature. So, in other words, he's trying to create this balance to where the federal government could negate state laws, but they also wanted to make sure that there was a limitation on the centralized powers. So this was one of those things that they were, you got to remember that the Virginia Plan basically converted the states into administrative bodies.
Okay.
So all Madison, right.
That's how the Virginia Plan started out.
Yes. So what we're reading does not make any sense to the Constitution. It is just kind of laying out this form of government where they do talk about breaking out. So the essential form, an executive, a judiciary, and a bicameral legislative body was literally delineated in the Madison Plan.
Okay, I get it. And part of my challenge in reading this is it's colored by my knowledge of the Constitution, but they haven't gotten there yet.
No, they haven't.
Okay. Mr. Madison observed that the more he reflected on the use of force, the more he doubted the practicability, the justice, and the efficacy of it when applied to people collectively and not individually. A union of the states containing such ingredients seemed to provide for its own destruction. The use of force against the state would look more like a declaration of war than an infliction of punishment and would probably be considered by the party attacked as a dissolution of all previous compacts by which it might be bound. He hoped that such a system would be framed as might render this recourse unnecessary and move that the clause be postponed. This motion was agreed to NEMCON. Okay,
so NEMCON means no one disagreeing.
Okay.
That's what that means. In other words, it was basically unanimously agreed to, no one disagreeing.
Okay. And then the committee then rose and the House adjourned.
Okay.
Okay.
So now we kind of have cleaned up and kind of gone through, because I just wanted to go through this, you know, they're chewing on the Virginia plan.
Right.
Now, I've said that they rejected the Virginia plan. They did, but they maintained the framework, and they actually changed a lot of the things that what Madison had submitted in his plan. Now, one of the things that I've always cogitated on, you know, I've thought and contemplated heavily, is why is it that Madison never went down the path of, you know, fighting changes to his plan?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even in his notes, he kind of reveals that at this point he doesn't have an opinion, but he lends more towards this because apparently he just didn't have pride in authorship.
Okay.
He just said, you know, this is what I think might be, you know, a fundamental start of the direction we need to go. We need to kind of do this. We need to break the magistrate model because obviously that was a part of his plan.
Okay.
And how, you know, there was, you could see somewhat a little bit of offense to some of the, or bias towards, you know, some of the comments that were coming.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it's not like he was, no, it's got to be this way. He didn't have that. Mm-hmm. It was kind of interesting how he was kind of void of that. But even more important is the fact that the framework of the government, what I mean, the dividing, the breaking up of the magistrate was truly a Madisonian principle, you know, that we had to get away from a top down because that's exactly it. But even though it was baked in his plan, he still had the people having representation, but the greater body, the second form of government, was going to come from within or by nominations of the state legislatures to, you know, this first branch who would then choose who would make up the second branch. And in other words, it still would have been a more, I will say, energetic and more centralized power where, you know, the swamp was going to be created a lot sooner had they gone down that path.
Yeah, okay.
So, anyway, so we don't have much time. We got about less than a minute left. What I'd like to do is kind of prepare everybody because there's some oration that's coming up in the next few days that I honestly think are kind of interesting in when they're talking about some of these principles. But what I think is more important this year is to kind of focus on the parts of the Constitution that are really pressing us, such as land ownership, electors, and choosing the president and so forth. So I think that's the way that we're going to try to help garner, help utilize the insights that this document provides. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.